And we'll proceed to the sixth case, Clark versus Lacy. Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Bradley Matthews, appearing today for Plaintiff and Appellant Marilyn Clark. Your Honors, before we begin our discussion or analysis of this Colorado River stay and its two-part test, I just want to make a couple of preliminary comments. First, with regard to the standard of review, as we noted in our brief, the standard of review becomes plenary if this court determines that the district court made an error in its application of law, and certainly that's our position here today. And second, Your Honors, with regard to the policy backdrop against which the Colorado River stay test is analyzed, I think it's, as we go through this, there's a couple of points to keep in mind in that regard. First, that the district court is only to abandon jurisdiction in extraordinary circumstances, and that the presumption is against abstention. More specifically, Your Honors, the rule is that the pendency of an action in state court is no bar to another proceeding in federal court, and these are the operative words concerning the same matter, which is what we have here today. With regard to the first part of the Colorado River stay test, there's just two primary issues, I think, that are pertinent with regard to determining whether these cases are parallel. And that's first with regard to the four named defendants that we have in the federal action that do not appear in the state court action.
Could I ask a question that's sort of tangentially related to that? Are you asking for different relief in the New York case from the case here, and how can these four individual defendants, given the fact that this is fundamentally a derivative action, change? How do you expect that they're going to change the relief you could get?
Well, they're interrelated, Your Honor, and the short answer to your question is yes, and actually we think it's a very pivotal part of our case. Because it's a derivative action, Your Honor, there are two components to the remedy. Certainly, there's the issue about whether Sears is going to be compensated financially for its losses, whatever those may be.
Right, and I understand that four more defendants is four more potential pockets from which to get money to go back to Sears to reimburse it for whatever it may have lost should you prevail. What about equitable relief? What can these people possibly do for that?
Well, that's the focus of the federal action, Your Honor, and in the way that the four additional defendants tie into it, I think it's twofold. First of all, because we're seeking equitable relief, typically in the form of corporate governance changes, one of our goals is to make sure that these type of shenanigans don't happen again in the future. Holding these four individuals accountable and keeping them in the litigation serves to send a message that the future CFOs, the future chief accounting officers, the future vice president of finance for Sears, that they will be held accountable and that they cannot hide behind the...
What do you envision the injunction to say? Some code of conduct for CFOs or...
Well, it's not an injunction, Your Honor.
Well, what kind of equitable relief? Why for that kind of institutional correction, which obviously is, you know, a piece of a larger puzzle, I would suppose, in today's world, but why would that require the personal participation of these particular four defendants in the case as opposed to the set of people who are before the court in New York?
Well, strictly speaking, Your Honor, it's a matter of justice in finding that these people are held accountable. This case.
Well, wouldn't money? I mean, that money would hold them accountable. If they have to pay damages, obviously they know something's happened to them. But on the equitable side, what do they? I still don't understand what they add.
Well, their addition to the litigation, Your Honor, is that in the form of the equitable relief that we would seek in terms of the corporate governance changes to make sure that there are stricter guidelines, that there are things put in place to prevent specifically this kind of thing from happening again in the future. And if the culpable parties are there and they are held accountable.
Well, what are they going to have to do? What do you envision happening? Tell me what the order looks like.
Well, it may be nothing more than a symbolic finding that they are held to be accountable. I mean, we have the board of directors.
So that's almost a declaratory judgment. You violated the law. Or something. I mean, because your opponents argue that this is, that although you're relying on the difference in the party lineup in the two cases, that it's actually, while factually true, not something as a matter of law that prevents these from being parallel suits, because it really just doesn't make that much difference. And that's what I'm trying to get at. I would like to know why they're wrong.
Why they're wrong in proceeding, allowing the state court to proceed absent these individuals, Your Honor?
Or at least at the moment they're not there, as I understand it.
Right. Well, I think that requires a focus on what the underlying facts are and what has brought us here. And this has to do with financial restatements about Sears' endeavor to gain a foothold in the finance and credit industry through the issuance of MasterCard.
And that's going to be covered in the New York litigation. I mean, it seems to me what you're seeking is some general, you did wrong, you should do better in the future, and here's how you should do better, which I don't even know if you can get that here in federal court. I have my doubts about that. But it seems to me getting the core case resolved would be beneficial, and we're not talking about your clients being shut out forever. It's just until the New York litigation is resolved. And those core issues, it seems to me, have to be decided, particularly if you're looking at governance issues. And some of those issues may, in fact, wind their way into the New York litigation.
Right. I think a lot of it has to do with accountability. Although the gatekeepers, which is the board of directors, is responsible for the oversight and for the management of the company in general, and the issuance of these false statements regarding the financial condition of Sears, these four individuals, I would submit, are the active wrongdoers in allowing these types of things to happen, and it's really a matter of accountability. I mean, certainly Sears will be compensated financially for whatever losses they have, but I think that the equitable relief that we seek in terms of making sure this doesn't happen again in the future by fixing what internally allowed these problems to happen at Sears is a very important part of the case.
Well, and don't we have to establish that there were problems with Sears in the first instance, and isn't that what the New York litigation is going to do?
Well, right. That will be through
discovery. So then if we want relief, don't we have to know what the wrong, if they're found guilty or liable in terms of the wrongdoing, to how we're going to get to relief?
Right. Well, I would agree with you, and this is getting back to the primary issue here is whether or not this goes into determining whether or not the cases are parallel. And I would submit that the fact that we are pursuing this a different route of the equitable remedy is a primary aspect of our case. In addition to making sure that Sears is financially compensated, which is not a part at all of the state proceeding.
The federal proceeding here is just stayed, and I understand that there are these differences, but I wonder, given the fact that actually time is limited, suppose, contrary to what you're arguing, we were to decide that these are parallel enough to be parallel, and we were to look at the exceptional circumstances factors of Colorado River, this case is going to be governed by New York law, right? So that would certainly suggest the New York forum is a preferable forum to some federal court in Illinois. Order of filing strikes me as at best neutral. I know not very much has happened, but it doesn't push you toward Illinois, at least. Piecemeal litigation, I think there's some Cook County cases that are stayed. How do these factors play out?
Well, I'm glad you bring that up, Your Honor, because certainly what the cases that have said that have focused on these enumerated factors, I think they're very clear about when and under what circumstances they either lean in favor of a stay or they disfavor a stay. And just to touch on your point about this being governed by New York law, the fact that state law governs cannot in and of itself favor a stay. The primary reason being is it because, as the courts have said, it relegates plaintiffs fitting in diversity in federal court to some kind of secondary status as to plaintiffs that are in federal court on federal question
jurisdiction. Right, but it's not just state law. I mean, if it were Illinois law, that would be one thing, but it's New York law before a New York court with the authority to do something about New York law.
Right, and I would say that in response to that, Your Honor, that the answer is that it's not an unsettled area. It's not an area where the federal court is going to be called upon to predict something in some amorphous way. I mean, this area of the law is settled, and I don't think that just the mere observation that this is governed by New York law in and of itself favors a stay. You also mentioned the relative progress of the cases. I see my time's up. With regard to the relative progress of the cases, Your Honor, it's not a first filed rule. I don't think any of the cases have found that it's a first filed rule. And being that this is less than 2 weeks between the filing of the action and the fact that there's been no difference in progress made, that cannot weigh in favor of a stay. Your Honor also mentioned the, if I may continue, just for another. The avoidance of piecemeal litigation factor. I think the Moses H. Cohn case followed up the Colorado River case, confirming that unless there's a strong federal policy that says these kind of cases need to be considered together, they need to be litigated together, that this can't weigh in favor of a stay either. I think the bottom line is that these five factors upon which the district court relied in saying that a stay was warranted are essentially all neutral, and that there's been no explanation as to why, for example, just to take the fact that New York state law governs, why, beyond that mere observation, it favors a stay.
Well, this case can't be removed to federal court. That is in New York.
That's right. And, Your Honor, I think the Seventh Circuit has been clear that when removal is not an option, that factor does not weigh in favor of the stay, that is also neutral. And that has been followed up by the Starr case in the Northern District of Illinois. I think the bottom line is that these factors that the district court relied upon clearly do not weigh in favor of a stay, and that these policies regarding a district court retaining jurisdiction should govern.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Mr. Hirschman.
I guess it's afternoon, Your Honors. Good afternoon. No court has faced a situation where the plaintiff has suggested that the cases aren't parallel when the cases are both derivative from the same absolute plaintiff, the corporation. This individual has no particular right different from the plaintiff in the New York action. Both of them come to court and say, we are standing in the shoes of the corporation and trying to assert the rights of the corporation. So the round trip situation, which is what has led to all of this Colorado River analysis, is simply absent here. What we would have is a situation where a plaintiff says, I can sue you in state court, and then I can come around and I can sue you again in federal court for the same cause of action, and I can move both of them forward. That's absurd. Our tolerance for parallel lawsuits as a necessary concomitant in federalism is not so broad as to permit the plaintiff to cause two suits to be brought on the same cause of action, where we wind up in situations where Frankfurter said there's a race to judgment, in situations where what the court was talking about in terms of zealously guarding jurisdiction, where the defendant, for instance, does have the right to bring the matter to federal court and the plaintiff has the right to bring the matter in state court, those are situations where the race is acceptable, a necessary cost of our federalism, but clearly not something which anyone would endorse as a sensible way to use judicial resources.
But, that may be true, except that I don't see in Colorado River itself the court saying that the exceptional circumstances test it lays out applies differently if it's, let's say, two different manifestations of the plaintiff, as we have here, given the way derivative. We have competing class actions that get filed all the time. This is not the only instance in which we see this. And the court seemed to say, you're supposed to decide these cases unless something really out of the ordinary is present.
Well, what they say is that if you don't accept that Cohn puts a gloss on Colorado River about saying, look, let's look at the test of wise judicial administration. which Cohen says explicitly is
right.
the overriding criteria. And you can't argue that wise judicial administration permits these two lawsuits to go on at the same time. And what the plaintiffs say is, well, we added four defendants. But I think Judge Williams pointed out why, as in the Ingersoll case with the Belgian judgment, once the determination is made in New York, if there is some reason to deal with these four people individually in the federal action, that can happen. They can go back.
This is just a state. Nobody's dismissing anything.
Exactly. So they can go back to Judge Norberg and say, look, you know, these four dudes weren't taken care of, and now we're going to do it. Now, of course, it is an incredible, I think, stretch to argue, looking at this complaint, which intentionally does not individualize any claims and groups everyone together, to stand here and say these four defendants did something particular. They obviously could have pled, and if this was a federal securities law claim, would have had to plead something individual about them, but they chose not to. So here they are telling Your Honor there's something special about these four people, but their complaint says nothing about it. In addition, their complaint says that they want damages. It says nothing about all this prophylactic remedies. There's obviously, it's clear that New York, if this is going to be a case of first impression about prophylactic remedies of New York corporations, ought to, under subtle factors, get the first bite at it. This court, or the federal court sitting here, shouldn't be placed unnecessarily in the position of having to make those kinds of decisions. Which
is there any reason to think that equitable relief would be unavailable in New York?
No, of course not. They have the, if you look at the, and amazingly, the plaintiffs say that they're, you know, that they need equitable relief, but of course on the face of their complaint, what do they ask for? They ask for a jury. Now, it is simply completely inconsistent with settled concepts of fiduciary duty to believe that they're entitled to a jury and an injunction when, particularly, they haven't divided up the injunctive remedy. Indeed, the injunctive remedy is sub silentio, whatever else the court wants to do.
Certainly the rule in federal court said you don't have to plead remedy very specifically, and I thought it was the same in New York, actually.
Well,
you get whatever you're entitled to.
I think that is correct. But to stand here and say that the purpose of our lawsuit is this kind of reform when all that is requested is damages, and that is confirmed by the idea that they are asking for a jury, has to lead you to be concerned about what is really the motive force behind the complaint. And in that sense, they are trying to create a distinction which doesn't exist between the two actions. So I think, and in addition, I think the court has numerous times, Sverdrup in particular, determined that this is a deferential standard to the trial court. It clearly isn't an error of law in a fundamental sense to hold that two cases brought by the same plaintiff against almost all of the same defendants, growing out of this, you know, market drop in the stock, aren't parallel. It would really distort logic and common sense to reach a conclusion that these two cases aren't parallel. You would have to do precisely what the courts have rejected countless times, which is take some small distinction and blow up that small distinction into a distinction that makes a difference. Here, the distinctions don't make any difference. Four additional defendants don't make any difference. And the thrust of the two complaints is the same. So we think that Judge Norberg did what he was supposed to do. He weighed the factors. I believe that it is common sense to say that there is an adequate remedy in the New York State Court. Obviously there is. You know, the Internal Affairs Doctrine is all about state courts dealing with the internal affairs of their own corporations. So clearly they are the best suited to look at these issues. We look at progress now. There's a motion to dismiss, which has been argued, and we're awaiting a decision to see whether demand should have been made. There's obviously concurrent jurisdiction, and the source of law is New York. The only thing that they have here is that most of the defendants are Illinois residents. But that can't be the controlling proposition, because there is no showing that these defendants aren't obliged to defend in New York.
I was going to ask you that. I take it it's clear that personal jurisdiction will exist over everyone in New York or not?
You know, Your Honor, if New York, and I don't know the answer to this question, I'm sorry I don't, if New York has a parallel provision to Delaware.
Delaware, yes.
In Delaware, there's
we
no
question. We would
know
it would be true in Delaware, but I don't know.
I just don't know the answer off the top of my head, and I apologize.
That would make a difference, obviously, if somebody's going to roll in with a personal jurisdiction objection.
But I will tell you this, that no defendant has made a personal jurisdiction motion in New York. So on the state of this record...
Would it be too late to do so at this point?
I believe it probably would be too late since we moved on other grounds. I believe that as in Illinois, I don't think you can just split up your motions. So, with all due regard to the plaintiffs, this case fits squarely into a case which is appropriate to be stayed. Indeed, it is the best use of judicial administration, and anything that is left over can be brought back to the trial court if and and when the New York court reaches a conclusion. Thank you.
Matthew, your time expired, but you may have a minute.
Just a couple of really quick points. Clearly, the distinction between whether or not they're parallel and whether or not the case is properly stayed under Colorado River under the second part of that test is much more difficult to overcome the first part, the fact that they're parallel, when the only analysis is whether or not they're substantially the same issues and substantially the same party. There's a lot more room for judgment there. Your Honors, the primary focus of our argument here today is that, as a matter of law, that the Seventh Circuit has held that the unavailability of removal does not favor a stay. That as a matter of law, the fact that New York law governs by itself without further reason does not favor a stay. With regard to the fact that the piecemeal litigation issue, I think one important piece of information here is the demand futility issue. As counsel mentioned, there's a current motion pending to dismiss in that case. I think it's highly likely that if the federal action is stayed and the demand futility issue is allowed to be decided in state court, it could very well prejudice my client's rights with regard to that same issue in federal court if that judge is inclined to be deferential to what the state court found when the demand futility analysis is complaint specific. There would be no preclusive effect. And I think that fact alone makes this particular case different, because I don't think this court has ever considered two derivative actions under the Colorado River analysis, and I think that's a very key component. It's always the first hurdle, always the major hurdle in these types of cases. Unless you have any questions.
I think not.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.